Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me okay? I'm never accused of being too quiet, actually. So I'd like to thank Gioia for inviting me here today to share some of my work with you. I've just moved to New York State and taken a position at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, the Smart Lighting Engineering Research Center. So I haven't set up a lab, so I'm going to present today a bit of where I've been, what I've done, and where I hope to go in the future. About 1.2 billion years ago, a eukaryotic cell engulfed a cyanobacteria, and that's when higher photosynthetic organisms started to develop. They have evolved for that length of time under a fluctuating light environment, as well as other parameters, of course. And so I'm interested, actually, in the fluctuation of light and in the acclimation processes that have developed during this evolution. Sorry. Of course, the advent of LEDs have given us a tool where we can mimic fluctuations in light. We can drive these light sources sequentially or in phase, and we can duplicate a lot of the light distributions, spectral distributions that we see in nature. And we can elicit responses at a whim. So what kind of light do plants use? What do they need? This is a chlorophyll fluorescence imaging of a transverse false color light micrograph of a snapdragon leaf. And they used lasers at 660, 532, and 480 nanometers. So you can see that at the top of the leaf, the blue and red light is absorbed because chlorophyll fluorescence is actually the re-emission of absorbed light. The green light goes all the way through the leaf, and they looked at direct and diffuse light in this study, and they diffused the light by bouncing the light off a series of mirrors. And they saw that, yes, in fact, light absorption is altered somewhat under these two conditions. And this actually matches well with Terashima et al.'s work, where they found that photosynthesis is driven more efficiently on the abaxial side of the leaf by green light when compared to red and blue light. So the entire spectrum is utilized by the whole leaf. So when I moved to Sweden and started my work on light and plants, we visited a greenhouse in Orust, which is on the west coast, just north of Gothenburg, just across from the northern tip of Denmark. This was in December, and we were hired to actually do a light assessment of a greenhouse so that we could help assist and recommend lighting for their specific needs. Now, this is quite an extreme condition. I actually have done most of my work on extremophiles, so I was very comfortable in this location. And we measured the light outside of the greenhouse during a typical day in December. And along the y-axis, you see the spectral irradiance in microwatt per centimeter squared per nanometer. This is the unit that we had to use because our device gave us this unit, and we didn't actually translate it over to micromol. And you can see at 8 o'clock in the morning there, the sun hasn't quite come up. We have wavelengths along the x-axis. By 9:30, the light was coming up. It's a low blue spectrum, red enriched. By 11:30, the intensity peaked at about 1,300 microeinstein or micromol. We had a 1-to-1-to-1 spectral distribution across the wavelengths. 2:30, the light's starting to go down. We had a blue-enriched spectrum, and then by 4:30, it was pretty well dark. So in a greenhouse, you do not have a static light environment. It's very dynamic. Looking at this visually, you can see throughout the day not only a change in the intensity, but a change in the spectral distribution as well. And so we were able to look at this and to check their program to see when their curtains were opened and closed, whether it was worth actually saving the heat by closing the curtains and decreasing the amount of light. So it was a really useful tool for the greenhouse, but also for us in our work in trying to figure out the best light for plants. Not only did we look at the light, but we looked at the physiological state of the plant. We measured maximum PS2 photochemical efficiency, which is essentially how well photosystem 2 can push an electron through the unit. We crawled and climbed and checked plants throughout the greenhouse for 24 hours a day over a 3-day period. And we found that FE over FM, which is a stress indicator, was always above 0.8. These plants were fine. They were acclimating and using acclimation processes to the fluctuations in light in the greenhouse. Now, looking at the coefficient of chlorophyll fluorescence quenching, which we call photochemical quenching, this indicates really the probability that photosystem 2 will absorb a photon. And it's an indicator of how reduced the photosynthetic electron transport chain is. And we found that there were fluctuations in QL, which is the parameter that we measure. And this fluctuated quite a bit. At zero, you have all photo system 2s are closed. And when QL is 1, they're open. And when they're open, they're able to do work, and they're able to photosynthesize. So we found quite large fluctuations in this parameter throughout the greenhouse. So this indicated to us that, in fact, there were excess electrons sitting in that photosynthetic electron transport chain, and that this is inefficient as far as light goes. Why shine light that isn't being used in photochemistry? We did look at non-photochemical quenching as well. This did fluctuate relative to location and time of day, but they were minor, and it also indicated to us that there are other dissipative mechanisms going on that we didn't measure. So a greenhouse is a dynamic environment. The plants are undergoing acclimation processes, and how well they acclimate really depends on the phenotypic plasticity, just like Sophia indicated this morning. Some plants are more phenotypically plastic than others and are able to acclimate. So again, we have to select plants that are able to do this. So just acting on this dynamic light in the greenhouse environment, we decided to grow plants under LEDs, which are the first three plants on your left, and under HPS. This was done in a laboratory. It was a dark room, temperature controlled, of course, same photon flux utilized throughout. On the right-hand side, you see our typical HPS response. You've got a long hypocotyl and a good enough plant, a little chlorotic. But fine. We developed a basic LED regime. You see that plant on the left. We used 7 different wavelengths of light of LEDs, and we put those into a combination that we spent years developing, and we found the best one for this particular cultivar of basil. Now, in Europe, the Germans like their basil short, and the Swedes like their basil long. Or tall. So how can we actually grow the same cultivar of basil and please both markets? Well, we set up dynamic regimes. We changed the spectrum 4 times a day, and we were able to actually alter the plant. With the second plant on the left, the LED2, we were able to shorten it a bit, but the LED3, of course, we were able to stretch those plants and keep the Swedes happy with their basil. So I'm particularly interested in sensing networks in plants. And I'm not going to talk about photoreceptors here and photomorphogenesis because we have the world experts sitting in this room. But I do want to say that they are important in plants, and we can utilize the knowledge to adjust the morphology and the biochemistry of many different plant types. However, photomorphogenesis is useful. It drives development and differentiation of plants, but it doesn't supply, of course, any energy that's required for growth. So during my time in Europe, I went to visit Julian Ma at the St. George's University Hospital in London. He actually inserted the gene for an antibody that would fight HIV in hopes of developing a good, inexpensive system for developing countries. They thought that the antibody would be produced in the leaf, but it wasn't. It was actually excreted by the roots. And so they grew these plants, tobacco plants was their model, in small little plastic boxes in about 30 mils of media. And so they would take this media off every couple of days and, of course, get the antibodies from that. Now, these plants were growing under HID or HPS lamps, and they were tall, gangly, sticking to the sides and rotting, and really not happy. And this really inspired me. So I went home to the lab, and I immediately started work on tobacco to see, one, how could we arrest development using light quality, and how we could keep the lamp, the plants shorter. As soon as these plants went into flower, of course, they would stop the development of these antibodies. And so using LEDs, these are tobacco plants, the same age, grown under very subtle changes in the spectrum. You don't need to change the spectrum a lot to elicit big responses. And so we were really happy that we were able to do this. So now we go into where my passion really lies, the chloroplast. This is a cartoon of a plant cell. We've got the chloroplast there. We've got the nucleus. Of course, they've omitted the mitochondria, and I apologize to any mitochondrial people in the room. But it is it's an important organelle in plants as well. So we see photosynthesis here going on. The two photosystems absorb photons of light. Electrons are extracted from water at photosystem 2. These are transported through the thylakoid membrane via a series of electron carriers and goes through PS1, where it eventually reduces NADP+ to NADPH, and this is used as a reductant in cell metabolism. You also, of course, at the same time have the production of ATP, which is not on this picture. The chloroplast is a distress center. This is the first place where any type of stress or fluctuation is perceived, and it's also the organelle that dials 911, although I think that's 411 in the States, I'm not sure. 112, it's 911. Good to know. So the chloroplast not only senses light, it will sense changes in CO2, temperature, nutrients. It is the sort of powerhouse of the plant cell. And it's where it houses most of the key enzymes and reactions in all of the secondary metabolism as well. We really need to have a well-functioning chloroplast for any of these responses that we're seeing today. Oh, sorry. So the chloroplast, of course, the photosystems are also detectors of light quality. We have P680, which preferentially detects at 680 nanometers and is activated there, and PS1, which detects which absorbs 700 nanometer light. And this always makes me question, in many of our light sources that we have today commercially, there's no 700 nanometer wavelength. So I guess they're using the blue, which is maybe a bit less efficient. I'm not sure. I haven't done those measurements. So the chloroplast, it's a light harvester. It supplies energy for growth and development. It also dissipates energy because, of course, light is paradoxical. Plants need it, but it also damages the cell as well and the photosynthetic apparatus. It's a sensor and it's a signal. And it not only signals within the plant cell, it signals systemically. This signal is actually transferred through different parts of the plant, and it also signals extracellularly, and we can exploit that and have been exploiting that since the 1950s to look at plant photosynthetic efficiency. Now, redox acclimation or photosynthetic acclimation is actually a response to fluctuations. It's not a response to maximum light intensity or to DLI, daily light integral. It is a response to changes in the environment. And this was really beautifully spelled out by Durnford and Falkowski with this equation. On the left-hand side, you've got sigma PS2. This is the functional absorption cross-section of photosystem 2. It's the probability that a photon of light is going to be absorbed and utilized. You've got I, which is irradiance. So the left-hand side of the equation is actually light-dependent. Now, doing work in this area, we've only looked at light intensity. We've never figured this out for light quality, and now we have the ability to do that, and that's one of the things I'm going to do back home as soon as I get my hydroponic unit set up in the lab. We really need to understand how light quality affects the redox status of the chloroplast. On the right-hand side, we've got electron sinks, so that's sulfur, nitrogen, carbon metabolism, and we've got 1 over tau, which is the turnover rate of these sinks. This side of the equation actually gets thrown off by temperature or nutrient availability. So you always have to have this balance in a chloroplast, and as soon as this goes out of balance too far, that's when you have death. It's just like the human cell and homeostasis. As soon as we can't maintain some kind of order, we die. So what does this look like in the real world? On the left-hand side, you see a cross-section of a pine needle, and you see plants that were grown under what we call high PS2 excitation conditions. This can either be high light or low temperature. And you see the production of anthocyanin under these circumstances because the plant is trying to balance the energy in the chloroplast. On the right-hand side, we have green algae. And you've got the two cultures on the left that are green. Those were grown under low PS2 excitation pressure conditions. And the two cultures on the right were grown under high PS2 excitation pressure conditions. And you see that there's an obvious change in pigmentation. Just below this, we have an immunoblot looking at protein concentration of proteins in these organisms. And we see that, and this is for the chlorophyll B binding protein. So we see that not only do the pigments change, but of course, at a molecular level, we have a decrease in the transcription of chlorophyll B binding proteins. We have a northern blot underneath this. This is looking at the mRNA. Again, these processes, which happen actually on a sub-second level, change the protein levels and the gene transcription because the mRNA follows the expression of the protein. On the bottom, we have an immunoblot again, looking at the proteins, the carotenoid binding proteins, and these are increased, of course, under cultures grown under high PS2 excitation pressure conditions. So this is something that we're not really talking about in light quality yet, but something that I really want to figure out, and I really want to work with photomorphogenesis so we can figure out if there's any crosstalk between these two really powerful processes. So using and throwing the redox status out of balance in a cell is a really fast way to elicit responses and to obtain desired attributes. You can alter light harvesting. This might be very useful, especially in biofuel production. They want to actually truncate and keep the light harvesting complexes small, so that they can shuttle more electrons into butanol. So this is one way we can do that. You've got state transitions and the stoichiometry of the photosystems that can be altered. These are a little more long-term, especially the second one. And state transitions aren't really that important in plants. They're more used in algae. You've got changes in the pigment complement. This can happen within minutes after throwing an organism under high PS2 excitation pressure conditions, especially zeaxanthin, which is one that I'm particularly interested in, and lutein. I really think that any compounds that will help macular degeneration would be useful, and this will happen actually within half an hour of putting your organism under high PS2 excitation pressure conditions. It will alter leaf and plant anatomy. We've seen this. The plants are shorter, some of them, not all, when grown under high PS2 excitation pressure conditions, and there's a change in the root-to-shoot ratio as well. And there's a memory. Now, this is a kind of a sexy term we're using now for plants. In the old days, we called it hardening off. And so essentially what you're doing is you're poisoning the plant. When you grow plants or algae under high PS2 excitation pressure conditions, you're poisoning them for secondary stresses. They are less susceptible to stress, for instance, during shipping, or actually if they're just exposed to a breakdown in the irrigation system or temperature control in the greenhouse. So growing plants under these conditions will help actually tolerates other stresses. So under a grant from the Swedish Foundation for Strategic Research that I obtained with Torsten Wijk at Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden, we looked at biofeedback. Because not only do plants use the chloroplast as a sensor within the cell and the plant, it actually will give us signals that we can use. So we grew plants under both LED and HPS, and under various or under a special combination of wavelengths, and we excited the plants with 420 nanometers, and we measured 685 and 740 nanometers back. Actually, we measured from 380 to 750 nanometers and looked at about 36 different signals, and we came upon this one was the best one. It was more robust and it gave us more information. So you can see the two sensors we had there. We just used spectrometers that we just hung a fiber from the top to measure the signals from the plant. We were working a meter away, which was quite fantastic, using a really big fiber, about 600 microns. And then we measured the light coming from the lamp. And we did this experiment in four phases. The first phase was really low light, about 80 micromoles. Then we exposed the plants to what we were calling medium light, about 470 micromoles. Then we pushed it up to 1,800 micromoles for phase three, and then we recovered under low light. So we watched the plants remotely to see how they would do. This is a bit of a nightmare. I apologize. Now, this was basil plants. We grew them, and this was done when the plants were in mid-logarithmic phase. And we grew them under low light, under LEDs and HPS. And the green dots indicate FV over FM, so that's a stress response. The lower FV over FM goes, the more stress the plant is under. However, stress is not always bad, and this could be a whole talk in itself. The blue lines indicate the fluorescence gain, so we're just measuring 685 and 740 nanometers. So we can see two things here. One, FV over FM and the fluorescence gain actually follow each other. And two, so this could be a good parameter to measure to indicate stress. Two, the LED was less susceptible. The LED-grown plants were less susceptible to the stresses, especially under phase three, than the HPS-grown plants. So we're inducing some kind of memory in our light regime. Now, when we do the same experiment on high light-grown plants, we see a different effect. So again, not only do we have effects of light quality, we have effects of intensity thrown in. And so these plants, you can see that one, the FE over FM did not follow the fluorescence gain, and there's a definite pattern to the fluorescence gain. These plants have developed a memory, and especially under phase three where you've got the really high light, they're not as susceptible. So it fits all of the data that we see. And again, we see that the plants grown under the specific spectral composition were not as susceptible to plant stress, at least high light. So now we're back to New York, and the first work I did was at Gotham Greens with Jen Nelken and her crew. And they did a fantastic job collecting data. We ran six different trials from December till April in their greenhouses, and we used three different commercially available LED fixtures as well as HPS. And here's the spectral distribution. You see on the top left there, you've got the HPS, or standard HPS. It's a very green, red spectrum. You've got spectral irradiance along the y-axis, wavelengths along the x-axis. And we've got lead A and lead B. I'm not mentioning any names here. And they're both red and blue. And we've got lead C, which is obviously a phosphor-converted LED spectrum. So we measured plant height, which I know isn't a good indicator of growth. We measured fresh weight. We measured number of leaves. We just did a, you know, is this plant look good, how green it is. We didn't really have the resources to do a really in-depth study. And we did see that one interesting thing that came up over and over again was that lead A grown plants were always shorter, they had less fresh weight, they had the same number of leaves. So there was clearly something going on. And these were both grown under blue and red LEDs. That was an average over the six different trials. So let's look seasonally what we have here. And these six trials, again, occurred during December, from December to April. We do see a seasonal effect. See a rise there in trial 3 and 4. And this was the same effect, again, that we saw in fresh weight. But we do, again, see consistently, almost consistently, that lead A plants, grown plants, are, you know, not as tall and actually not as much biomass as lead B. So why is this? What's happening here? Is it location? We turned off the lights every now and then, actually once each trial, just to measure the natural light in the greenhouse. And we saw that under lead A, there was a bit more natural light available to the plant. However, during the winter months, there's not that much light. And we had to work hard to find a sunny day to do this. And we did keep the artificial lighting or the electrical lighting at about 100 microeinstein. When we look at the spectral composition, they're almost identical. So we've got, you know, 13% roughly, you know, blue. We've got low green. We've got high red. And we've got a really high red to far red ratio. If you're going to compare this to the HPS, you've got 4% blue, 48% green, 48% red, and a red to far red ratio of about 4.3. The phosphor converted LED is kind of in the middle here. So this doesn't explain what we saw in the greenhouse. But what is different in these two different fixtures is actually the peak maximum for the blue. There's a 30 nanometer shift. So again, when we're talking about growing under LEDs, it's really important that we, you know, talk about, that we show the spectral distribution, that we look at the peak maximum, because I know Kevin's lab has found, Jochen's lab has found that even a 10 nanometer shift is enough to really morphologically alter and biochemically alter a plant. So this winter, I'm going to be reproducing this data. I want to find out why the LEDA fixture is different than the LED blue, and I'm going to look at the photochemistry and see if we can't find the answer there. So conclusions in the future, wavelength matters. And so when we were talking about standardizing yesterday and standards of LED, it's pretty hard to do because really, we're only looking at a snapshot under a specific condition. The whole spectrum is utilized, and I don't understand why we only have red and blue LEDs to work under. Not only is that the whole leaf isn't photosynthesizing under those conditions, and if you're in a situation where you're using integrated pest management, it's really difficult because, of course, most insects' photoreceptors lie in the green and UV ranges. So we're not really able to use IPM under these conditions. It's a dynamic solar spectrum. So let's go dynamic. Let's have fixtures that we can alter during the day on a microsecond level to an hour level. All of the knowledge that we have to date that's published in journals is basically a single observation. So it's really hard to make a unified picture or a general picture of what is going on because there isn't one yet, and there probably won't be. We really need to work together on photomorphogenesis and redox acclimation or photosynthetic acclimation so that we can actually really drive. We're not growing plants anymore. We're driving plant growth, and we're directing them. And we have that power to do that now. And we can use actually the physiological state of the plant. Rather than having your environmental sensors, why not just sense the physiological state of the plant and have that operate your control systems in the greenhouse. I mean, if you're making assumptions when you're just measuring the environment, saying, oh, the temperature dropped to this, we're going to do this. Why not just look at how well the plant is doing and base your control systems on that? So I'd like to acknowledge many of the funding agencies that have been supporting me over the last 6 months. The Smart Lighting ERC is an NSF funded center. We're in year six, and part of year seven coming up, they've actually agreed to include plants and horticulture into their program, and I'm really pleased. I'm a bit of a lone island in a sea of engineers, but I've been there before. It's actually a lot of fun. Of course, NYSERDA, who funded the work that we were able to start at Gotham Greens. And we'll be continuing that work again this winter, and we're going to actually increase the intensity and do a few more experiments that we feel could be useful. Thank you very much.